Deadline's Palestinian resistance groups hail an operation in the city of Eilat as a natural reaction to Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. The European Union offers some changes to its proposed ban on Russian oil imports amid growing divisions in the bloc over the issue. And also in our headlines, the British opposition Labour leader says his party has reached a turning point following local elections that saw the ruling Conservatives suffering major losses. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, Palestinian resistance movements have praised Thursday's operation in the Israeli city of Eilat that killed three people and wounded four others. The groups say the operation is a consequence of Israel's raids and brutality across the occupied territories. Hamas said the operation represents Palestinians' anger over Israeli attacks on Muslim holy sites and proved that Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line. Islamic Jihad said the Palestinian people will respond to Israeli crimes, and the Palestinian Mujahideen movement said the operation is a natural reaction to Israeli attacks on Al-Aqsa. Israeli police say they've identified two suspects from the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. A manhunt is now underway. Israel has also closed crossings to the West Bank and Gaza Strip. It says the closure will remain in place until Sunday. Political commentator Bruce Katz says Israel, being the occupying regime it is, continuously tramples on the rights and religious beliefs of the subjugated people of Palestine.
Well, my first statement is the simple fact that violence begets violence. And, you know, the Palestinian people have been subject to what I consider to be state-sponsored terrorism for decades. It is inexcusable that Israel has allowed and supported extreme right-wing settlers to basically invade the Al-Aqsa compound, the Al-Aqsa Mosque being the third holiest site in Islam. There's no surprise whatsoever in the fact that there has been a return of violence against Israeli citizens. An occupying force cannot continuously trample on the rights of a subjugated people, trample on their religious beliefs, basically wipe their feet on a sacred shrines, and expect that this people will simply lay down and continue to take it without responding.
Day 72 of Russia's military operation in Ukraine, a fresh UN-coordinated effort is underway to evacuate more people from a besieged steel plant in the Russian-held city of Mariupol. A convoy is en route to the city to rescue the last group of civilians from the site as part of the UN's third joint evacuation operation with the Red Cross. An estimated 200 civilians are thought to be trapped inside the Azovstal factory, the last stronghold of Ukrainian forces in Mariupol. Some 500 civilians were evacuated in the two previous phases over the past week. On Thursday, Moscow announced a daytime ceasefire for 3 days to allow civilians to get out of the city, but Ukraine says there's been no pause in fighting at Azovstal. Russia says it has no intention of using nuclear weapons in the Ukraine war. The foreign ministry slams its, quote, deliberate lies reports by Western media suggesting the possibility of a nuclear strike by Moscow.
As I have already said, we have repeatedly had to refute insinuations about Russia's possible use of nuclear weapons in the course of its special military operation in Ukraine. This is a deliberate lie. Russia firmly adheres to the principle that there can be no winners in a nuclear war.
Zaitsev said Russia's use of nuclear weapons in Ukraine is ruled out since it's not in line with the objectives of its military operation there. Russia's ambassador to Washington has also reacted to the Western accusation. Anatoly Antonov says such, quote, baseless allegations are part of a propaganda campaign against Russia. The diplomat also accused the West of misinterpreting Moscow's recent decision to place its nuclear forces on high alert. He said the move was in response to extremely controversial, or confrontational rather, statements by Western countries that possess nuclear weapons. U.S. officials say Washington provided Ukraine with intelligence that helped its forces hit and sink a Russian missile cruiser. Media reports have quoted the unnamed officials as saying the intelligence was about the location of Moskva, the flagship of Russia's Black Sea Fleet. The officials, however, claimed the United States didn't know Kiev would target the warship with two missiles. Russia earlier said Moskva had gone down while being towed back to port after ammunition on board caught fire. Since Russia began its operation on February the 24th, Ukraine's Western allies, especially Washington, have been ramping up support for the country. Washington is also said to have been providing Ukrainian forces with intelligence about the locations of Russian generals on the battlefield. Moscow says Western military support for Ukraine threatens security of the continent. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban says a proposal by the European Union for imposing sanctions on Russian oil is unacceptable to his country.
Russian or any type of oil can only arrive via pipeline, of which one end is in Russia, the other in Hungary. This is a condition we have. We cannot accept a proposal that ignores this, because this proposal in its current form equals an atomic bomb thrown onto the Hungarian economy.
Still, Orban said Hungary is open to negotiations if its interests are considered in a new EU proposal. The Hungarian Prime Minister also referred to similar sanctions previously imposed by the EU over the war in Ukraine. He said the punitive measures will lead to problems bigger for Europe than Russia. The European Commission proposed a complete ban on Russian oil imports this week. Apart from Hungary, the Czech Republic and Slovakia are also opposed to the embargo. Meanwhile, Brussels has reportedly offered some changes to the embargo to give countries more time to prepare for the move. The Italian government is reportedly considering introducing a new state of emergency linked to the conflict in Ukraine, a looming energy crisis, and the grave deterioration of the country's socioeconomic situation are among the reasons. Max Schuele reports from Rome.
It was March 31st when the Italian government put an end to a 2-year state of emergency due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Just over a month later, some Italian media are reporting that the Mario Draghi government is mulling over issuing a new state of emergency linked this time to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. Some newspapers have even suggested that Draghi is considering postponing next year's general elections. The Ukraine war and the subsequent sanctions imposed on Moscow, in addition to Rome's decision to significantly cut off its supply of Russian gas, have had a ferocious impact on Italy's already struggling economy.
A government of common sense always works on dealing with more than just one scenario. Suggesting the adoption of war economy and new lockdowns is very much premature. I'd rather focus on diversifying Italy's energy supply sources and tackling unemployment, which is likely to soar significantly in autumn.
The National Association of Entrepreneurs, Confindustria, has recently said Italy's economy is heading for recession, which is defined by 2 consecutive quarters of GDP negative growth. Last month, the Italian government revised down its 2022 economic growth forecast to 3.1% from a 4.7% projection made last September, a forecast considered optimistic by most independent bodies. Economists have warned that surging food and energy prices will seriously affect Italians' spending power, leading to an excruciating decline in domestic demand. It is also estimated that 500,000 workers are expected to lose their job should Italy completely halt its gas supplies from Russia.
Giving up the Russian supplies will be a catastrophe for the European manufacturer, and for Italy this would be managed only through a profound alteration of the democratic rules.
Last year, Italy had recorded a strong recovery from its economic contraction of nearly 9% in 2020 due to the restrictions adopted to counter the COVID crisis. That recovery has been cancelled by the measures undertaken to sanction Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Max Civili, Rome.
Results from Thursday's local elections in the UK are coming in with Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party losing three traditional strongholds in London.
Local Conservatives, 1,680. Dobres, Lizzie, Labour Party, 2,070.
Labour has taken the three councils in Westminster, Barnet and Wandsworth, its leader Keir Starmer says. His party has reached a turning point and is back on track to succeed at the next general elections. Outside London, the Conservatives also lost control of councils in Southampton, Worcester and West Oxfordshire. Meanwhile, the Liberal Democrats have enjoyed good results, gaining 59 councillors. Following the Conservatives' losses, some local council leaders have called on the Prime Minister to resign. They blame the rising cost of living and a number of scandals engulfing the Premier, including lockdown-breaking parties at Downing Street. Johnson has acknowledged it has been a tough night for Conservatives in some parts of the country while enjoying success in other regions. The United States is notorious for imposing sanctions that are blamed for the suffering of ordinary people in several countries. America is sticking to its dangerous policy despite widespread criticism.
The United States is a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council. That title means a lot of responsibility, as every permanent member is expected to remain committed to global security and collective council action. But the U.S. has shown for decades that it is very much ready to take unilateral measures to get what it wants. A case in point is America's sanctions policy. The U.S. has gone outside the U.N. Security Council mechanism to impose tough unilateral sanctions against many countries. Even close U.S. allies may become a target of American sanctions. This is the Harry S. Truman Building in Washington, D.C. It is the headquarters of the United States Department of State. Many major U.S. economic sanctions programs targeting countries around the world are devised and enforced by politicians, diplomats, and lawyers who work here. From coercion and threats to financial punishment, the team does everything to make sure the sanctions are enforced. Perhaps the harshest sanctions ever imposed by the U.S. have targeted Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the Russian Federation. America usually defends its sanctions policy, claiming that it is aimed at changing the behavior of foreign governments. But ordinary people in targeted countries have been bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The United States uses the sanctions as a form of hybrid warfare. It is a form of warfare, it's economic warfare, and it's a modern-day version of siege warfare. So you can imagine that the United States, without committing troops on the ground, uses sanctions as a tool in its arsenal for regime change and for pressure campaigns, both politically, militarily, and economically, on countries that do not kowtow to it, do not bow to it, and do not follow Washington's policies.
In Iran, the sanctions have caused economic hardship for people, among other problems. Iranian cancer patients, for instance, have been hit hard by the adverse effects of sanctions. That is because many firms, financial institutions, and banks, which are vital in importing medicine, have been blacklisted by the U.S. State Department.
Iran has been hit by many waves of unilateral American sanctions. The current U.S. administration has failed to fulfill its promise of lifting them. United Nations experts have called the anti-Iran measures unjust and harmful. As we'll see in this next report, Iran's U.N. envoy condemns the imposition of unilateral sanctions on countries, saying they mostly affect ordinary people by preventing access to essential supplies.
Iran Iran has been targeted by some of the harshest American sanctions in decades. Washington refused to give Tehran any relief, even at the height of the coronavirus pandemic, when all countries needed much more financial resources to battle the disease. Although Iran has many years of experience dealing with such economic restrictions, a considerable part of its problems are being blamed on them. They have put a lot of pressure on Iran's economy, causing its currency to lose value and pushing up its rate of inflation to unprecedented levels over the past years. Iran's UN envoy has called on the world body's Department of Global Communications to intensify its efforts to inform the international community about the adverse effects of sanctions on the targeted countries. Addressing a session of the UN's Committee on Information on Wednesday, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations said the use of the coercive economic measures are contrary to international law, international humanitarian law, and the UN Charter. Majid Takht-Ravanchi noted that the sanctions have undermined economic growth in the target countries and prevent their access to basic medical equipment and materials by blocking their financial resources overseas.
People can't have access to proper medical supplies, food, different types of technologies that are necessary, for example, aviation. You can think of transportation, things like that. Raw materials that are necessary just for basic industry and production. And overall, you see that there is a massive pressure put on the population in terms of their economic power to purchase consumer products because of the sanctions that are imposed. So it puts tremendous pressure on civilian population.
Iran has in the past described American sanctions policy as economic terrorism. Tehran says the U.S. is addicted to such coercive tools. Despite criticism from around the world, the United States does not seem willing to change course anytime soon.
After 2 years of stifling restrictions, the South Korean government has lifted most social distancing limits over COVID-19. As the country sees a decline in cases, South Koreans should still wear masks indoors, but restrictions on gatherings have largely ended to the relief of service industry businesses. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Over the next 50 years, climate change could drive more than 15,000 new cases of mammals transmitting viruses to other mammals, according to a study published in Nature. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Natasha Gilbert Ryder. This article is published under the heading Climate Change Will Force New Animal Encounters and Boost Viral Outbreaks. Here's the details. Over the next 50 years, climate change could drive more than 15,000 new cases of mammals transmitting viruses to other mammals, according to a study published in Nature. It's one of the first to predict how global warming will shift wildlife habitats and increase encounters between species capable of swapping pathogens, and to quantify how many times viruses are expected to jump between species. Many researchers say that the COVID-19 pandemic probably started when a previously unknown coronavirus passed from a wild animal to a human, a process called zoonotic transmission. A predicted rise in viruses jumping between species could trigger more outbreaks, posing a serious threat to human and animal health alike, the study warns, providing all the more reason for governments and health organizations to invest in pathogen surveillance and to improve healthcare infrastructure. The study is a critical first step in understanding the future risk of climate and land use change on the next pandemic, says Kate Jones, who models interactions between ecosystems and human health at University College London. The research predicts that much of the new virus transmission will happen when species meet for the first time as they move to cooler locales because of rising temperatures. And it projects that this will occur most often in species-rich ecosystems at high elevations, particularly areas of Africa and Asia, and in areas that are densely populated by humans, including Africa's Sahel region, India, and Indonesia. Assuming that the planet warms by no more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures this century, a future predicted by some climate analysis, the number of first-time meetings between species will double by 2070, creating virus transmission hotspots, the study says. Gregory Albury, a disease ecologist at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and a co-author of the study, said, "This work provides us with more incontrovertible evidence that the coming decades will not only be hotter but sicker." To make their predictions, Albury and his colleagues developed and tested models and ran simulations over a 5-year period. They combined models of virus transmission and species distribution under various climate change scenarios, focusing on mammals because of their relevance to human health. The team built the species distribution model to predict where mammals would move to find more livable habitats as the planet warms. The virus transmission model predicts the probability of a virus jumping between a species for the first time by taking into account their species might meet as their habitat shift and how closely related they are evolutionary. "The modeling seems technically impeccable," says Ignacio Morales Castilla, a global change ecologist at the University of Spain, although he points out that forecasting exercises such as this sometimes needs to include unrealistic assumptions, but he adds that the breadth and scope of the research and its ability to identify which parts of the world might be most at risk clearly stand out. One assumption the researchers had to make was about how far and wide species would spread as the little climate changes. But factors such as whether mammals can adapt to local conditions or physically cross barriers in landscapes are difficult to predict. Bats are projected to be involved in viral transmission regardless of these factors, the study found. Thought to be part of the origins of COVID-19, bats are known reservoirs of viruses and make up about 20% of mammals. The team says that in part because bats can fly, they are less likely to experience barriers to shifting their habitats. Although Jones applauds the study, she urges caution when discussing its implications for human health. Predicting the risk of viral jumps from mammals into humans is more tricky, as these spillovers take place in a complex ecological and human socioeconomic environment, she says. Many factors could reduce the risk to human health, including increased investment in healthcare or a virus being unable to infect humans for some reason, she adds. But the researchers urge that there is no time to waste. Earth has already warmed by more than 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures, and this is driving a species migration and disease swapping. It's happening, and it's not preventable, even in the best climate change scenarios, Albury says. Albury and one of his co-authors, Colin Carlson, a global change biologist, also at Georgetown University, say that even though some increase in disease transmission is inevitable, that is no excuse for inaction. The researchers call on governments and international community to improve the monitoring and surveillance of wild animals and zoonotic diseases, particularly in future hotspots such as Southeast Asia. Improving health infrastructure is also essential, they say. As people begin to prepare for and adapt to global warming, most efforts focus on activities such as halting deforestation or reinforcing sea walls. But Carlson says pandemic preparedness and disease surveillance are climate change adaptation too.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
What you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
The U.S. government has extended the federal student loan payment pause for a sixth time. 46 million Americans are still in debt over their student loans. Now, progressive politicians warn inaction on student loans could hurt Democrats in the next midterm elections. Opposers of loan debt cancellation believe that these cancellations will only increase the current alarming inflation rate. Now, this is the second consecutive year that the federal budget deficit will exceed 10% of the GDP. a non-unified Democratic Party and opposition of Republicans over debt forgiveness has left the U.S. student loan debt crisis in limbo.
Never-ending student debts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in today's episode, we'll discuss the student loan debt crisis. Will recent pause in payments bring much-needed relief to millions of borrowers? With university tuitions ever so high, will there ever be a solution to student loans? And has the government fulfilled its campaign pledge to solve this pressing crisis? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our show, Scott Hutchins, speaker at Picture the Homeless, and Jameson Brewer, professor of social foundations of education out of the University of North Georgia. Stay with us.
Student loans have been in place in the United States for hundreds of years. However, the first federal student loan was provided in 1958 under the National Defense Education Act.
In the 1980s, the government drastically cut federal subsidized higher education funding, and as a result, university tuition skyrocketed. Then came widely available federal loans in the 1990s, which were not subsidized. So what are some of the problems with student loans today?
Well, most people can't afford to go to college without student loans unless they get some kind of scholarship, and most people don't get scholarships. And since most good jobs require you to have a college degree, whether you actually need one is another story, but since most of them require you to have a college degree, that's what they're asking for. So people need to go to college and get these degrees. And then they come out and they can't necessarily find jobs with these degrees because the market is oversaturated. So there are too many people trying to get this small number of jobs that require degrees. And then they're stuck with these loans that are often at very high percentage rates, often like 9% or so. And people try to defer them, and they can only defer them so long. Then you get like income-based repayment plans. Of course, if your income is nothing, you don't pay anything. But people are in this situation where they have this massive amount of debt. They have a promise where that if they went to college, they'd be able to get a good job. And that promise hasn't been realized. A lot of people with college degrees have good jobs, but quite a few don't.
Now, over the past decade, student loan debt in America has more than doubled from $750 billion to $1.75 trillion. Now, this amount is almost half a trillion dollars more than total auto loan debt in the country. The Biden administration is under enormous pressure to reduce this burden of debt. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Elizabeth Warren are demanding the government cancel over $50,000 per borrower. So why have the debts increased so much over the past decades?
Student loans became important, particularly post the Reagan administration in the 1980s. Prior to that time, and here in the United States, state universities were heavily subsidized by state legislatures and state budgets. Following the 1980s, we in the United States had a reimagining of what higher ed would look like, specifically no longer conceiving of it as a public good or a common good, but thinking about it in terms as an individualistic commodity. Because of that, states have dramatically cut back their subsidies for higher education institutions in the United States, and as a result of that, those costs have been shifted to students. Because those costs have been shifted to students, and over the past couple of decades, the costs have increased over time, students have been forced to turn to student loans to pick up the difference. And so we've seen a shifting of state funding of education here in the United States towards individual funding. And again, because most students cannot afford out-of-pocket to pay for tuition and fees, they have to resort to student loans.
Some Democrats fear that if the Democrat government does not take a decision on canceling these debts, they would suffer in the upcoming midterm elections. According to a recent poll by the Student Borrower Protection Center and Data for Progress, nearly 66% of likely voters support the forgiveness of student debt. The poll also found that more than 70% of Latino and Black voters also support this initiative. So why did Biden make a campaign promise over student loans?
A lot of it is just bloat, because the money really isn't going to the professors. The professors' salaries have basically gone up with inflation. A lot of it is just they just expand all these administrative positions. A lot of it's redundant. A lot of it's administrators giving jobs to friends and friends' kids. And that increases bloat. Some of it's used for capital improvements. A lot of colleges do a lot of building that they don't necessarily need to do, just to try to make themselves look better. And so a lot of the money goes to those places, but the place that it doesn't go to is hiring more professors, giving the professors better wages.
Since Biden took office, the U.S. Department of Education has canceled around $2 billion in student loans for more than 100,000 borrowers who have filed application alleging fraud and deception against their school. This is while in the Trump administration, tens of thousands of similar requests were rejected by then-Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. Now, there is a proposal that in schools that are proven to be problematic, entire groups of student loans should be canceled. So why are university tuition fees so high?
Institutions, especially these, as we have shifted to thinking about higher education as an individualistic commodity, universities have operated along the marketplace theory. That is that if they have the better and the nicest recreation centers or dormitories, they can attract students for their business, for their money. And so there's some increased costs there. Certainly there have been some administrative bloat over the past couple of years, and I think that the combination of all of these things, and again with the reduction of state subsidies, we've seen an increased cost over the last 30 years.
Opposers of loan debt cancellations believe that the payment pause that's been underway now for more than 2 years primarily benefits the wealthy and those with higher incomes. Students who enrolled in expensive private schools or went to graduate school are the ones who have the most debt. Now, these same students are the ones who are probably wealthier and earn more income. So is canceling debt now fair to those who have paid their loans off over the years?
The ones who've paid it, it's difficult to say that they're suffering more than those who haven't paid it, because if they've paid it, that means they could pay it. A lot of the people who have not paid it have not been able to pay it. So it's giving them relief, but it doesn't hurt the people who had their student loan debts and who paid off their student loan debts on their own. It's basically just a resentment issue. Was like, well, I paid off my student debts, why didn't these other people? It's like, because you got a good job and the other people didn't. So I don't really think there's a very good argument against forgiving these student loans, because the people who paid them off are the ones who could.
Community college attendees normally have less than $10,000 in debt, while graduates from private universities that go to law schools or earn their MBA, for instance, might earn six figures and have probably accumulated more than $150,000 in debt. These wealthy graduates have enough salary to pay back their loans, but now they have not been paying for 2 years and might have their loans totally forgiven. Is it correct to invest so much in higher education and not more in other areas like housing?
Yeah, certainly an individual buying a house benefits the local economy. I think that it's clear that an education and what we invest into an education tends to provide better and broader impacts and a return on investment, to use the language of a business. So investments in education, again, not only impact and benefit the individual, but they benefit the communities that they live in, the states that they live in, and the nation as a whole. And so if we have the question of, you know, do we fund education or do we fund housing? I mean, for me, you know, I would like to have a conversation about how do we do both, but I do think that there tends to be a larger return on investment when we make those into education.
The other matter to take into account is that the poorest people in the U.S. probably have no student debt at all, since they have not gone to college. According to the Pew Charitable Trusts, only 15% of U.S. adults have student debts. Although young adults with a degree have more debt, with a bachelor's degree they earn 80% more than their peers in the same age group who have only earned a high school diploma. Why not pay off mortgages of low-income individuals instead of canceling student debt?
I think that's a good idea. I don't think it needs to be an either-or issue. I think there is a bit of an aspect of how much society pushed us to go to college, and that is a major factor in it, is basically because we were given all these promises that didn't work out. But I'm definitely in favor of people having their mortgages forgiven, especially if it's on their own home. If they're a landlord, I'm not so keen on that. But if they're just trying to survive, I would agree with forgiving that as well.
Now, there are reports that a program which was developed to aid low-income borrowers and eventually offer debt cancellation was not functioning the way it was intended to. More than 9 million borrowers have enrolled in the Income-Driven Repayment Plan, the IDR, which are developed for low-income people that can only make modest monthly payments. The NPR revealed that these plans have been badly mismanaged by loan servicers and the Department of Education. So has Biden fulfilled his campaign pledge on student loans?
I mean, I can certainly appreciate that disposition. I think that, you know, we also see this when it comes to K-12 funding. You know, there will be individuals in the community who will not have children, who attend public schools just because they don't have children, or perhaps their children are grown and have moved out, who will say it's unfair for them to continue to pay local taxes to support the local schools. But of course, the problem is that even without children or children who moved on, those individuals still benefit from a community and society that makes sure that the youngest of us have an education. The same thing for college. I mean, I can appreciate that somebody who spent the latter two decades paying off their student loans might feel left out. And I think that from a policy standpoint, there can be many ways in which some of the fees that have been paid or the interest that has been paid by those individuals over the last few decades can be reversed. They can be given tax credits. I'm not an economist, but certainly it doesn't have to be black and white that if you've already paid them off, you get nothing if we move forward with loan forgiveness. But the same thing is true across other policy areas. Myself, my children are a little bit older now, and we don't use pre-K anymore. But there are conversations about making universal pre-K free and affordable to everybody. That wasn't necessarily available to us, but I'm okay with us not having gotten it as long as people in the future and families in the future can get it.
Borrowers are supposed to see their loans canceled after 20 to 25 years, but new documents show that in 2021, while there were 4.4 million people who had been repaying their debts for at least 20 years, only 32 had their loan canceled under the IDR plans. Now, some senators are calling for an investigation into these mismanagements at the U.S. Department of Education. Has the government been successful in canceling loans and giving relief during the pandemic?
It hasn't at all. I mean, Jen Psaki basically said, it's not going to happen. You're going to have to start paying again during the pandemic. It's really, there hasn't been any change. I think it was just a campaign promise to try to get the youth vote. And I think he succeeded in getting the youth vote, but he has not fulfilled the campaign promise in any way whatsoever. He had that little bit of a freeze for the pandemic, but then it was just announced that you're going to have to start paying again. The pandemic's not even over.
What is interesting is that despite opposition claims that the forgiveness of loans benefits the wealthy, a new Grinnell College National poll shows that only 12% of those making $25,000 a year or under oppose forgiving the loan, while 44% of those who make over $100,000 a year are against cancellation of debts. And those with high school diplomas support forgiving loans just as much as those with the higher education. Now, wouldn't canceling the debts cause inflation?
I'm not particularly clear on any connections with canceling student loans and Obamacare or access to health care. Certainly, because the United States does not have single-payer health care, individuals have to pay for that. If individuals are not having to spend money on paying for their student loans, that would certainly free up money for them to help afford their own personal medical insurance programs. But in terms of inflation, something like 65% of the current outstanding student loan debt is simply interest. It's projected interest on what student borrowers owe the federal government. So that's not necessarily money that they would have to print, so to speak, to cover if they forgive it. That's just simply money that the federal government would not collect, right? And so the entire $1.7 trillion of outstanding debt, if it were to be forgiven, more than half of it is just simple interest, right? It's not the actual principal. So would it contribute to inflation? I think that that's possible, but I also think given the context of the pandemic that we've been in for the last 2 years, since COVID began, the federal government has suspended the requirement to pay student loans. Me, as an example, I have student loans, and over the last 2 years, rather than paying towards those loans, I've used that money to spur the local economy, buying supplies to build onto my house and all those other things. So I really think that some of the impacts of inflation that would follow from forgiving student loans has already been priced in to the economy, because that extra money that student borrowers would then have in their pockets per month rather than paying, they've already had that for the last 2 years. So in terms of would it exacerbate inflation worse, I'm not quite certain on that.
With high inflation and the increase of living costs, millions of people owing student loans are still stressed and worried of what is to come. Millions of Americans are in debt their entire lifetime, and now that there has been a two-year pause for student debt, experts are worried that borrowers have been spending their monthly installments on other costs of living and will not really be able to pick up where they left off once payment pause is over. Now it's time we check in with Abbas Motarim to see what he has for us this week.
Student loans, they are designed to keep corporations in control and to maintain this capitalist society. In this episode of Power to the People, we're going to take a look at the student loan debt crisis, and we'll look at why it's used to maintain capitalist control over our daily lives. Student loan debt, it has millions of Americans trapped in the cycle of perpetual debt. Currently, student loan debt is estimated to be nearly $1.75 trillion, and it's spread out amongst 46 million borrowers, and this is a huge number that only continues to rise. But it wasn't always this way. Shoot, if you go ask your parents, they're gonna tell you how college was cheap, cheaper back in their day. And they's not wrong, as one of the main people responsible for student loan debt is none other than Ronald Reagan. Even while he's in his grave, his policies, his economic policies, are still terrorizing people. In 1981, the Reagan administration, alongside Republicans and conservative Democrats, they passed a combination of tax and budget cuts that significantly cut student financial aid as well as Pell Grants. And thus, federal loans, they were only made available to a small amount of the population. This was part of the conservative ideology that there should be no handouts, and this whole welfare queen idea that people should pick themselves up from their bootstraps and go get a job and work to go to college. And one of the reasons financial aid and Pell Grants were cut was also to deter Black people from going to school. In the civil rights era, Black students, they were beginning to get better access to education. And with that access, many Black students, they were beginning to organize against white supremacist capitalism. Many of the radical movements of the 60s and the 70s, they started off on college campuses. And the biggest militant movement to be born out of the student movement was the Black Panther Party. And the Black Panther Party, they had its roots on Merritt College campus in Oakland, California. The campus was so Black and so militant, the Wall Street Journal, they called it a campus where Black power won. J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director of the FBI, he declared an all-out war on the Black Panther Party and deemed them to be the biggest threat to national security. The government did anything and everything to destroy the party. At the height of the Black Panther Party's organizing, Ronald Reagan, who was the governor of California, and he worked actively to stop the Panthers. So it's to no surprise that he would attack the school system in order to stop revolutionary organizing that was going on campus. And with a significant cutting of financial aid from the government, college, in many ways how it always was now exclusively in many ways for those with wealth. And because, let's be real, those with wealth, they ain't trying to change society, they want to keep it how it is. And for those who can't afford college, they now got to take out loans in order to gain access to education. And this makes a huge barrier for education. And now Black people are more likely to have to take out a loan to go to college and borrow more than the average college student. And white students, they are more likely to graduate with a rate of 250% more compared to Black people. And this is all because of the financial challenges of the student loan crisis. The American government puts those who can't afford college in massive amounts of debt. And in many ways, this is entrapment. Rather than people now, you know, being able to actually chase their dream job or dream career, they often have to compromise because of the debt that is looming over their head. People then, in some ways, can become slaves to capitalism rather than pursuing what they really want out of this life. It must be understood that education is truly a human right. But instead, the U.S. government, they spend billions of dollars on wars. And when it comes to education, they would rather its own people spend the rest of their life in debt. This parasitic system of capitalism would rather make these corporate banks trillions than actually serving its own people. But this is exactly what capitalism is. It is inhumane, it is anti-human, and all it cares about is profit. And the only people it cares about is the people who is profiting, which is the ruling class. This is Power to the People.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.